From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1920, when American women won the right to vote all across this country. It had been a long time coming, of course. Susan B. Anthony did not live long enough to see it. And so what do you think was the outcome of those first elections in which women had the chance to cast ballots? As political scientist Christina Walbrecht points out, women voted in rather large numbers in places that did not put high barriers to voting. In other places, with poll taxes, literacy tests, for example, women voted in rather low numbers. And for decades, there was kind of a stereotype about women. They don't vote that much, and when they do, they vote how their husbands tell them to vote. Walbrecht has studied women and voting for years, and her work follows many threads. How does the media cover women voters? What issues matter more to women voters compared to men? How does wealth disparity impact women who vote? And how have populists around the world won elections with or without women voting for them? What about demagogues? Walbrecht will deliver a lecture for the University of Rochester this afternoon titled A Century of Votes for Women. We'll discuss the various themes involved and look at how leaders are vying for women's votes today. Our guests this hour include Christina Walbrecht, who has a long and distinguished resume. She's professor of political science, director of the Rooney Center for the Study of American Democracy, and the C. Robert and Margaret Hanley Family Director of the Notre Dame Washington Program. Christina, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Bonnie McGee is with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Rochester. Bonnie, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
We'll put a link on the website for Connections as a podcast this afternoon if you want to take a look at the 4 o'clock lecture and share it. But I want to start, Professor Walbrecht, with a question that I think maybe probably comes up quite often, which is, are you comfortable making general statements about women voting? And I'm sure some say, well, not all women vote the same, et cetera, et cetera. Talk about, if you could talk about what your goals are here when you look at how women have voted for 100 years in this country and some of what your research entails and some of what you're trying to understand now. How does that square with, you know, some who will say, well, you can't generalize?
Unfortunately, the someone who's going to say you can't generalize will probably be me. I think for 100 years, we, and by which I mean scholars and journalists and you know, politicians trying to gain votes, have spent a lot of time talking about the woman voter. And one of the things that's sort of impressive over this 100-year period is how consistent our assumptions about women voters are. To give just one example, you know, after the 19th Amendment was ratified, politicians sort of bent over backwards on appealing to women as mothers. They talked about child labor. They talked about maternity care. And I would suggest to you that 100 years later, we're still talking about soccer moms and hockey moms and all the rest. What we know is, despite, you know, so the goal of everyone to determine who are women voters and what do they want, that women voters are indeed diverse, that different women approach politics in different ways, and that while there may be certain tendencies among women, which I'm sure we'll get into, in the end, you know, women, it turns out, have the same sorts of identities and interests that men do, and lots of different factors impact their participation in elections.
Okay, and I'm glad to clear that up, just because there was a horrible movie called What Women Want, and I thought, apparently all women want the same thing. Apparently women all vote the same way. No, of course, there's a diversity in how women vote and who women are and how they approach different issues, et cetera. So when you look at the research that you've not only done, but the questions you're trying to answer, given that, you know, you want to be careful not to generalize too much, can you describe some of what you are sort of the missions of your study and your work, Professor Walbrecht?
Absolutely. So the book I'm going to talk about today, my most recent book with my colleague J. Kevin Corder, A Century of Votes for Women, wanted to sort of be a resource for scholars and journalists and the interested public to sort of understand women voters over this 100-year period. So there's sort of lots of work out there trying to understand women as political actors, and one of the goals in that particular book was to provide us with this narrative, this understanding. And the overall narrative is actually pretty straightforward, which is, you know, women entered the electorate, given all the bias against women participating, given the lack of opportunity to learn how to vote, Women's turnout was initially fairly low, but it has grown consistently over time and pretty steadily, so that by 1980, women were more likely to turn out to vote than were men, and that has remained true to this day, again, with really interesting, different patterns among different groups of women. The vote choice argument is or the vote choice narrative is a little bit more complicated. Not a lot of difference in the candidates and parties that women voted for initially after suffrage, but to the extent there was, it was actually mostly that women were more likely to vote for what I'll call internationally center-left parties. In the United States, that would be the Republican Party. And I mention this way of thinking about it around the world because this is actually a pattern we saw everywhere, that around the world, after women got the right to vote, they tended to be more favorable to center-left parties. By the middle of the 20th century, any differences decline, and then getting in the 70s into the and following, we start to see women more likely than men to vote Democratic in the U.S. and for left-of-center parties around the world. And, of course, as they switch to being left-of-center, their turnout is so much higher, and so the impact is larger as well.
I'm tempted to ask a really overgeneralizing question, but I'm going to set that aside for a moment and just ask you, and I'll ask both of you about that in a moment. But I want to ask about a historical parallel, perhaps, Professor Wahlbrecht, which is that, you know, when we think about 1920, you know, this is a city, obviously, Rochester is very proud of its legacy and ties with Susan B. Anthony and the work that she and her peers did for so many years leading up to 1920, which is why I think maybe the education is a little bit lacking about what happened next. And I say that because, you know, there's this assumption that, well, women could vote and, you know, women turned out in droves and it was this wonderful party of suffrage and pluralism, et cetera. But when we look at barriers to voting, whether it's literacy tests, poll taxes, et cetera, 100 years ago, and barriers to voting now, whether it's new laws or discussed laws, existing laws, what parallels do you see?
This is a great question, and I really appreciate you asking it. One of the things I'll talk about in my lecture tonight is how women's turnout was lower than men's all over the country, but it was in the 20s. It was particularly lower than men's in places, and some of these are the obvious places you'd think of, the American South, but also in places like Massachusetts and Connecticut, which had poll taxes, literacy tests, all the sort of historic and in some ways returning sort of barriers to voting participation. Here's one parallel. Turnout is not something that every person is equally likely to do. If you have a lot of friends that turn out to vote, if you've always been socialized to turn out, you're going to vote. If, however, you're someone who is perhaps not surrounded by people that vote, haven't had that sort of idea strongly socialized into you, you're less likely to vote. And for those sorts of people, any sort of barrier, we know, for example, that when it rains, people are less likely to want to get out of their cars and go in and vote on election day. Not everybody. You're not going to stop political science me from doing it. But lots of people have lots of things going on in their lives and not much incentive. So when you put up barriers, you're going to hurt, in particular, these groups that aren't as interested in sort of overcoming or maybe have been socialized to not participate. And what that means for women, especially at the beginning, was that they were very much hurt by these sorts of laws. Their turnout declined considerably. And you're seeing the same thing, I think, today. I think sometimes some of us look at these proposed legal barriers, and we think, well, what's the big deal? You can bring your photo ID. You can, make sure this or that is paid. You can get past whatever regulation it is. But if you already are burdened in many other ways, financially, in terms of your time, in terms of your resources, that's going to be enough to make it difficult for certain groups, systematically for certain groups, to be able to participate in democratic elections in the U.S.
And one of the justifications we hear it in Georgia, we hear it in a lot of places, is we just want to protect the integrity of voting systems. I don't mean to malign or mock that, but I do want to ask you if historically in this country when we see barriers to voting, is it about guarding against fraud or is it about limiting who gets to vote?
It is unquestionably the latter, limiting who gets to vote. We can talk about that in a historical way, and it's important to sort of step back as we think about all the different patterns that we've had in terms of voting rights, right? When the United States was founded, white men who owned property could turn out to vote, and this was like a democratic achievement, right? We're talking about an incredibly small percentage of the population. And as our ideas and as voting rights have expanded and retracted over time in American history, part of that has been, right, what qualifications, what do we think you need to have in order to be able to vote? What do you need to be able to prove that you can do? And that's a really deep question about what a democracy looks like and what's the right way to go about that. What we see in modern times, you are absolutely right that this claim that we need the integrity of the vote. And of course, knowing that elections are free and fair is absolutely key to democratic legitimacy. However, political scientists and other social scientists and scholars and researchers have put an enormous amount of time and effort into looking for voting fraud. People who are not qualified to vote participating in elections because they live in the wrong neighborhood, because they're not citizens, because they're ex-felons, whatever it might be. And the actual presence of voting fraud is extraordinarily small in the United States. We're talking about in all the state of Texas, fewer than 12, right? We're just very, very unlikely that voter fraud happens. And frankly, from my point of view as a scholar, the idea that people are out there wanting to vote when they're not qualified or wanting to vote multiple times, we just want people to vote at all, right? That's the hard thing. And so this idea that, like, lots of people are like, I'm really going to put a lot of time and money into casting one ballot in one county that will have no impact on the outcome of this election, I think strains credibility.
Well, and in a moment, I'm going to ask both of our guests about what we're seeing perhaps in trends around the world. I have some interesting listener feedback. Listeners, if you want to email the program with thoughts on women voting, A Century of Votes for Women is the book and the lecture at 4 p.m. this afternoon for the University of Rochester, our guest included, of course. And we'll put a link up if you want to take a look and share that and participate. But if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And the email for the program, again, is connections@WXXI.org. There was a moment in August, Professor Walbrecht, where I admit that even I was surprised. And it takes a lot to surprise me. We cover a wide range on this program, and I always appreciate a wide range of views. But there was a woman who spoke at the Republican National Convention who is an activist. Her name is Abby Johnson. She opposes abortion. She spoke at the convention passionately about abortion and why she opposes it. And she believes in I'm going to quote her correctly here. Head of household voting, which means only the head of a household casts a vote, essentially representing the household. Johnson said, quote, in a godly household, the husband gets the final say. So in her view, and she even joked and said, yes, it's true. How anti-feminist of me. So she her view is that, you know, that it is logical, even for people who are really engaged and really would like to vote, that a household turns to the head of the household, in her view, a man in a heterosexual relationship, and says, you vote, and that represents the household. I understand that is not a mainstream view on the left or the right in this country, but I was surprised to see someone elevated with that view speaking at a national convention, and I wondered if it is a... if that's sort of a harbinger of anything, or if that's more of an outlier. What do you make of that, Professor?
Yeah, harbinger is hard to govern. I guess I would say a couple of things. One is, it is really important to say that our vision of progress in voting rights, that over time we're just marching towards broader and broader enfranchisement, is simply not accurate, right? We've had periods of advances and expansion in voting rights, and we've had periods of retracting voting rights, and groups that had once voted not being able to vote, and so on. I am not particularly concerned. The things that I'm worried about right now, of a repeal of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That seems unlikely to me, but I don't think we should assume that rights, once granted, are always protected and always there. And we are seeing that in lots of the proposals in many, many states across the United States right now for retracting and limiting voting rights, right? So there's some reality there. The other thing I would just say briefly is that in making those claims, there's a callback to ideas that are very much grounded in our country's history. So historian Linda Kerber has talked about this concept of Republican motherhood, that when the founders wrote this Constitution and imagined this system based on the consent of the governed, they did sort of look out and think, okay, well, what do we do with women, right? Obviously, they're not going to vote, don't be ridiculous, but, like, what is their role in this sort of government? And the idea that it is the man's job to go out into the corrupt and dirty world of politics, and the woman's job to stay home, to raise up good sons, to be good citizens, and to provide sort of solace and support to her husband as he deals with this nasty and terrible world, was absolutely widespread throughout most of the 19th century. It's why the idea of women voting just seems so outrageous to people. I think one of the things we've seen, particularly in the last 10 years, is a return to some of these ideas that do have a long generation in American politics. I always say that when women in the 19th century, if women entered politics, they were thought to be, you know, they're off the pedestal and they've become dirty and unclean. And boy, I had that in mind when, for example, President Trump talked about nasty women, mm-hmm. right? These mm-hmm. long-term ideas really resonate in politics to this day.
Well, let me ask both of our guests, Professor McGeed, can you talk a little bit about why it is, if it is true, and I accept the research and the understanding that around the world, women tend to be a little bit more politically left than men. Why do we think that is?
Right. Well, it has been this gender gap in support for our political parties. My research is focused on Europe, and we've certainly seen that there. As Professor Wolbrecht mentioned, women tended to have been on the left for a variety of reasons. We often associate it with their socioeconomic position and their different issue preferences. These have been some of the arguments that have been put forward, so that women, when they entered the workforce, they cared about issues of pay inequality. They cared more about childcare. Women were in the public sector. These are jobs where they see greater support for the welfare state. And women might be more interested in questions like gender equality and women's rights. And these tended to have been platforms that at least recently, I should point out, in Europe, at least recently have been associated with the left. Traditionally, actually, women were underrepresented, and there have been arguments that women were underrepresented in the left because they were not considered, you know, the core constituency of the working class. Those were men. But in recent years, certainly women have tended to drift more to the left. Some of my research recently has been looking at the gender gap on the other side of the political space, and that is with regard to radical right populist parties. And so there we actually see the opposite. Maybe that's not surprising, but it certainly is stark when you look at the trends. So currently in Europe, the gender gap, the male-female voter ratio for radical right parties is effectively 2-1. These parties attract double the percentage of men than they do of women. And no other party family is that distinctive from parity, from 1-1 men-to-woman ratio. Even when we think about the left, as you mentioned, Evan, the Green parties, their ratio is 0.8, so 0.8 of a man for every one woman. And also, interestingly enough, Christian Democratic parties, which we think of as kind of mainstream center-right parties, also have more women voters than they do men voters. So we can't fully just say it's a left bloc versus a right bloc, but there are some really curious questions about what is drawing this, what is leading to these gaps, and my work is on how parties react to this, how they strategically try to overcome these gaps, or respond to the need to attract women, for instance. Radical right parties need to attract women if they're electorally going to be successful. And how do they go about doing that?
So what are you finding, especially in Europe, as to how these parties are navigating that gap and what they're doing about it?
Right. Well, so what this is part of a long-term project on radical right populist parties and gender, and it's a project with scholars from Arizona State University and the University of Bath in the UK. And what we were puzzling about was we noticed that there has been a marked increase in women's representation among radical right parties over the past 15 years. I should point out that these parties, this is puzzling because these parties are traditionally seen as Männerparteien, so men's parties. They are predominantly represented by, led by, and supported by men. And so we've been wondering, why has there been this change in gender diversity? What's going on here? And so actually, there have been a variety of ideas put forward in the literature. There are these things called gender quotas, which we can talk about at some point, or certain electoral systems are more advantageous for women, perhaps, than men, women representatives. But what we've argued is that these parties, these radical right parties, are highly cognizant of their gender gaps. And so when you have a male-dominated party that is losing support, they are going to have to look to appeal to untapped constituencies. They would do that for any kind of group that they're not currently representing. And it just so happens these male-dominated parties think, who is the untapped constituency? It's women. And so what we argue is that this is actually a fairly low-cost strategy that these parties can engage in to appeal to women voters by putting women in positions of power. So we see an increase in the percentage of women members of parliament when radical right parties have male-dominated electorates and they are losing votes.
Interesting. And you know, when people point to, for example, someone like Marine Le Pen, and you know, you'll hear this, well, if this was all about men and toxic masculinity and appealing to men, then how would Le Pen have risen through the ranks the way she has? Why would she be leading a party, ending up on a ballot? I mean, of course we see women on the right, and sometimes at the top of ballots, but does any of that sort of you know, sort of change the calculation of what we are seeing?
Right. Well, so Marine Le Pen is a really interesting example. Right now, across Europe, we see women as the heads of several of these radical right parties. So why is that happening? Well, some of the arguments put forward is that when these parties are failing, it's kind of a low-cost way of seeing, well, maybe this woman will shake things up. We actually don't see those figureheads having much of an effect on the number of women who become elected parliamentarians from that party. So that's kind of interesting as well. These women are not necessarily causing kind of shockwaves to go through the party culture. And so this is actually kind of concerning from a normative perspective. What are these women leaders and women representatives doing? Well, they could be putting a female veneer on some of these parties. And that, you know, if it's just about symbols, well, then that's a bit of a problem, because certainly there are women on the right who want their interests to be represented. They may vote for these parties because there are people like them in power. And if those women and those parties are not adapting their substantive goals, their policy goals, to match what women want, then there's going to be a gap in representation. Let me just say one other thing about Marine Le Pen. It's interesting. We actually are seeing, as I said, more of these women as leaders of the parties and representatives. And one of the things we need to keep in mind is often these women are part of political dynasties. So Marine Le Pen is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, the founder of the radical right National Front, or now National Assembly Party. So there is some degree in which these women might be discounted, maybe by other women or by the men supporters, as just being an extension of their fathers or their husbands or their siblings.
Interesting. Well, let me get our first phone call. This is Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
excuse me. What was just said, Evan, reminded me of Liz Cheney, and I'm wondering what her future will bring. But there would have to be, for some of us, a real facelift in politics with Liz Cheney, because we see some things in her that we wouldn't expect to find in her father. But what I wanted to talk about as briefly as I can is this thing about the difference. And really, the one clear difference that I see between men and women is something that Jane Goodall found, and it greatly disappointed her in men. And what she's, you know, working with the chimps and so forth, she found that she already had established and knew that they would fight for food and territory and a mate. But what she discovered is that, sadly, they would fight seemingly just for the fun of it, bored or whatever it was. And so the war thing, even if they had everything that they said they wanted or would fight for, still, they kind of like fighting. And I just don't see women as liking war. I can't tell you why there would be a difference, why men wouldn't grieve and regret what's lost in war, but that is what Jane Goodall said. Could your guests comment on that, please?
Yeah, Jane, I appreciate the phone call. And, you know, you may never have thought we'd see a day where Liz Cheney is viewed as a pariah in her party for being too far left in her own party. We'll see what happens with her political future. But on the story of Jane Goodall and how she saw the differences biologically, the idea, Professors McGeed and Wahlbricht, that Jane is raising is one in which it is often articulated like this. Well, if we just saw more women leading governments around the world, we'd see a heck of a lot less war. Professor McGeed, do you agree with that?
Well, of course. No, just kidding. That is a very good question, and I think it's one that we could empirically evaluate. One of the things that we see with regard to the attractiveness of radical right parties, or some of the hypotheses put forward, and this speaks to the caller's discussion about Jane Goodall, is the claim that men and women are differentially attracted to radical right parties because they hold different opinions on key issues like law and order, like stances on immigration and immigrants in society. And actually, we don't find that. There isn't a gender differential between men and women on their stance in favor of immigration restrictions. So that's interesting. That's about position on an issue. So men and women might be equally likely on that part of the spectrum to be anti-immigrant and to be possible supporters of a radical right party stance. Where we don't know yet, and we're still looking, is does emphasis matter? So men and women might have, men and women of different certain parts of the political space might have different priorities. So the men might prioritize questions of immigration, whereas the women might prioritize some other concern. And so here we see radical right parties beginning to reach out, diversify, and look to try to capture some of these women by highlighting issues that women might care about that are not necessarily inconsistent with the policies of policies that men have. On the issue of violence, actually, going to this point, there have been claims that women voters are going to be turned off from extremist and kind of outcast parties because of their rejection of violence as a mode. And that is something that needs to be looked at more carefully.
Professor Wahlbricht, have you found yourself thinking if we just elected more women, we'd have less war?
It's a great question, and I have to start by thanking Jane. I have a daughter named Jane, and partially after Jane Goodall. So this is a particularly lovely question. This idea that women are we'll say it in the negative way, not warmongering enough, and not capable in their own sense of sort of direct physical violence, is one of longstanding. And in fact, in the 19th century, one of the arguments arguments against enfranchising women is that basically anyone who votes needs to be able to defend the nation, that that's an important aspect of citizenship, and women couldn't do it. I think in modern times we see lots of examples of this. It goes more directly to expectations that women will be more collaborative, that we should elect more women because they're not so partisan, they find ways to reach across the aisle, and then, of course, this idea that women don't go to war. And that's an ancient idea, right? That we can go back to Odysseus and all sorts of ideas about women, and naturally, as mothers, caring more about human life, et cetera. In the U.S., there is some evidence that women are less likely to support the use of force in international conflicts, in the police forces, you know, so domestically, et cetera. But those differences are extremely small. We definitely see much bigger, you know, on average, gender differences on other sorts of issues. As Professor McGood said, you know, we can also look at this empirically. The truth is that women who get elected to office are not a random sample of all women in the world, right? So even if we thought on average women are less interested in war than men, the women who have to have the confidence and, frankly, the aggression to, you know, get elected to office and fight in politics maybe aren't that representative of women in general. And so we can think of lots of people, Margaret Thatcher, et cetera, world leaders who have, in fact, taken their countries into war. What we need to do as social scientists is elect a lot more women national leaders over a long period of time so we can study this more effectively.
Talking to Professor Christina Wahlbrecht, who comes to the University of Rochester virtually today via Notre Dame. She is the author of A Century of Votes for Women. And at 4 p.m. today, you can check out the lecture that Professor Wahlbrecht is giving. Professor McGeed is with us. They are going to be participating. You can check it out at 4 o'clock, and we'll post that link for you. It is all about A Century of Votes for Women. Professor McGeed is an associate professor of political science at the University of Rochester with a focus on Europe. So we've got a wide range of questions from the audience after this only break of the hour. Right back to your questions for our guests next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. There's been a lot of talk about not sending police, but sending mental health specialists to many calls. Monroe County is working on a model to do more of that, and we're going to talk about it in our first hour. In our second hour, Pittsford School District is in some hot water for a racist worksheet for a fourth grade class. We're going to talk about how we teach kids about slavery on Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. On the subject of participation in government, not only voting, but also who is represented in elected office, Roger says, Evan, here are some interesting stats that certainly argue for more women participation in government. Rwanda requires by law that 30% of all seats in its parliament be held by women. It is also ranked the 7th most efficient government in the world. In my humble opinion, women should not only participate in voting, but also participate in government in numbers more representative of their population. That is from Roger. Professor Wahlbrecht, what do you think?
I would love to test that hypothesis and have lots of national legislatures or state legislatures in which women are better represented. I guess I'll say two things before turning it over to my colleague. And one is that, you know, the caller rightfully points out that Rwanda has a gender quota. This is a requirement. These vary around the world. Sometimes they're legal. Sometimes parties themselves put them into place that says a certain number of candidates or a certain number of seats must be held for women for a bunch of reasons, sort of related to the distinct electoral system we have in the United States. That's not very possible in the U.S. I think it would also be opposed for other reasons. Americans in general don't like the word quota, but it's not one of the tools that we can use. And so in the U.S., we have focused on other tools. Leading amongst them is simply getting more women to run for office. Long before they're seated, we just have fewer women who put themselves forward, although, as I'm sure everyone knows, that's been changing and improving, especially in recent years. I guess the other quick comment I'll make is that nobody says the reason that men should be able to be president and hold office and do these sorts of things is necessarily because they're so much better at politics. And so I appreciate, certainly as a woman myself, that the efforts to talk about how much gloriously better government would be if there were more women in it. I would just want to point out that there's an argument that women should be elected simply on the basis of fairness and equality, that if we truly have a democratic system in which everyone's voice counts, then we should expect that government should reflect the variation in the American public. So I sometimes these broad claims of peace and streets paved with gold, if more women are elected, make me a little bit nervous because they set women up for standards and expectations that they frankly can't possibly meet. So I would encourage us to think of this as a question of justice and representation.
Professor McGeed, what do you think?
Well, we do see gender quotas being employed across Europe, as Professor Wahlberg mentioned. And what's interesting is that we've found that they do, in fact, have some positive effect on the percentage of women being elected as members of national parliaments. But they don't have an effect that's commensurate with the actual percentage that's put in these laws. So some of these laws say 50% of the candidates that a party puts up need to be women. And this, for instance, in France, and we do not see 50% of French elected members of parliament being women. Some parties have done a very good job of getting around the spirit of the spirit and the letter of these laws. By putting women lower down on like list ballots or putting them into seats where they are disfavored. Some of these parties have decided that I'd like to think it's because the pipeline is not there, that they just don't have women that are rising up through the ranks. Some of them might be doing it for ideological reasons as well, but they're willing to incur a fine in order to not put up 50% or whatever the threshold is stipulated. I should point out that no radical right party across Europe has voluntarily passed a party rule to ensure gender parity or gender quotas at the party level. And they would again say that it runs counter to the sense that of meritocracy.
Stephen writes to the program, Evan, great topic today. Question for your guests. Many people might feel that people like former President Trump got elected by appealing largely to straight white men and elements of what some might call toxic masculinity. If that is true, and I think there's some truth to that, how does your guest explain women who voted for him despite his clearly toxic language toward women? That is from Steve in Henrietta, and he is referring to, I think Trump won white women in both of the last two elections. He certainly won it in 2016. I haven't seen the 2020 final numbers, but he's referring to that at least in part. Professor Wahlberg, what do you think?
Well, the first thing I will say is that I'm going to talk about 2016 at some length this afternoon, and exactly this question, would love to see more people in the audience. Here's going to be my answer. I want to sort of think about the assumptions behind this statement of surprise, right? When you basically say, how could so many white women vote for Donald Trump, right? What are you saying? And the answer about 2016 is that the initial exit polls said about 52% of women. Later, better validated data said about 47% of white women. I'm sorry, let me be very specific, of white women voted for Donald Trump. It is the case that in every presidential election since 1952, with only two exceptions, a majority of white women voted for the Republican candidate. Whites are overwhelmingly Republican, and white women are no different in this sense than are white men. I think when we often talk about the gender gap, that women are more likely to vote for Democrats, what we hear is all women are Democrats. In reality, you can have quite a large gender gap if 70% of white women voted Republican, but 90% of white men voted Republican, it would still be the case that those white women were more likely to vote Democratic than were white men. But the difference is that white men were even more likely to vote Republican than were white women. And so I think that's an important sort of perspective. What I mean by assumptions is this idea that because Trump said and was credibly accused of doing horrible things to women, that that should be the prime driver behind women's electoral behavior. That first and foremost, they should look at the two candidates and think, who is most offensive to me as a woman or whatever that might be, and not think about their economic interest, their racial interest, their religious interest, their other policy views, et cetera, right? And also, of course, the presumption that only women should be offended by the things that Donald Trump said and did, that somehow, of course, I think it's sort of insulting to men, frankly, of course men should just not care about terrible things and terrible acts as long as they're perpetrated against women. And so once we sort of understand women the way we understand men, which is motivated by lots of different behaviors and lots of different interests and identities, I think the answer to that puzzle becomes more clear, that it may not, in fact, be a puzzle after all. The truth is the gender gap in 2016 was not very different than it had been in 2012, when the most offensive thing Mitt Romney said about women was that he had binders full of them. I guess I'll leave it at that.
By the way, that context, you know, that sort of juxtaposing what Mitt Romney said, it was its own little mini viral scandal when he said he had binders of women. What he was saying at that debate was, in a clumsy way, he had all kinds of qualified women candidates for different positions, that he's proud of hiring women, that he would hire. You know, it just, I mean, I understand what he was saying. It is so different than what Donald Trump is and said. And I admit, Professor Walbrecht, I admit that I was shaken in 2016. A lot of people point to individual moments in that campaign where they thought, well, how is this not the end? Or how is, you know, his comments about John McCain, his mocking of a New York Times reporter who has a disability. For me, one of the things that stood out was when he talked about, when he boasted about being able, as the owner and head of a pageant, to be able to, quote unquote, accidentally stumble into the dressing room where teenage girls and women would be naked and, you know, get a look because he could pull that off. And he laughed about that. When he did that, I thought, well, you know, certainly conservative voters, ostensible family values voters, are going to be done with that. I mean, how much I had to learn about the psyche of voters, Professor Walbrecht, I think I will never fully understand. And I'm not trying to be sort of like condescending to people who did vote for President Trump. I just didn't get it. I couldn't get it. Not just women, you're right, but maybe especially women, but not just women. So maybe there's something more to learn at 4 o'clock this afternoon for me.
Let me just say, and I'm glad you continued on this line, because there's something else I want to say, and Professor McGeed already sort of referred to this, which is that when we say he was such a sexist, and I think that's an empirical claim that I can back up.
Oh, sure, yeah.
How could women vote for him? I think it's important to say that sexism is not limited to men, and that there's lots of reasons to understand that for some women, and this explains opposition to women's suffrage, this explains lots of things, that sort of traditional gender relations, what I'm going to call patriarchy, they view that as being in their best interest, right? Patriarchy protects you. Patriarchy gives you a role in society that is respected and that is important to you, and that attacks on patriarchy. Think of sort of the reaction against Me Too are threatening to you. What if your husband, who just made a joke, can be accused of something? What if your brother or your son, you know, is falsely accused, or, you know, people misunderstand his actions? And so this presumption that only that men that all women oppose sort of traditional gender roles and that all men support them is of course inaccurate. And you know, you mentioned abortion earlier. Men and women are equally likely to have similar positions on that issue, for example. Now, as Professor McGeed rightly said, how much they emphasize that may be different, but honestly, it's not huge. And so, you know, you mentioned sort of evangelical Christians and their sort of respect for family, but there's of course also in there a respect and an expectation about traditional family arrangements and wives and, you know, very much traditionalized ideas about sexuality where it's women's job to sort of cover themselves to not tempt men. And so there's a lot going on there.
Mm. Professor McGeed, anything you want to add there?
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. And, you know, the great thing about studying another part of the world is that I also get to see how much what I've learned from European politics resonates when we talk about the United States. So never would I have thought that my academic work on radical right and some of these questions would be as relevant in the United States as it is today. So for better or worse, I guess I should say. I did want to point out one thing. What we do know about radical right populist parties in Europe is that there are very few issues on which everyone voting for those parties agrees. And they tend to agree on law and order and tend to agree on anti-immigrant positions. But that opens up a whole variety of other positions that these voters might have. And so it might be that, you know, they're being drawn to the radical right parties because of this law and order position, but they could have positive, more liberal stance on the economy, or they could have a more restrictive stance on the economy. And so we need to understand, as Professor Wolbrook has said several times, that women is not a monolithic category. And this is why when we're thinking about why women, I mean, I thought the question would be why some women do vote for these parties. And it might be because they see themselves as homemakers or mothers or tenders of the household. But there's a really interesting another approach that these radical right parties are engaging in now, and it's called femo-nationalism. So these are generally anti-immigrant parties that are anti-Muslim. And so they're reframing their anti-Muslim position in terms of a pro-feminist stance. So they are talking about being anti-headscarf or anti-burqa because it reduces a woman's ability to be seen as an individual. It represents her oppression by a patriarchal society. So this, we don't know yet how resonating this femo-nationalism is going to be, but it will be something for us to pay attention to. Can radical right parties appeal to women as feminists to get them to support them? It's just a really interesting question for the future.
Well, and maybe that's a good place to ask both of you a question as we get ready to wrap the hour. You know, you bring up Professor McGeed appealing to women as feminists, and sometimes you see debates about what feminism really is or what it should represent. So, Professor McGeed, how do you define feminism in 2021?
Oh, gosh.
I'm so glad that went to her first. Good job.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Darn it, went to me first. I don't know, Evan. This is hard. You know, it's traditionally been associated with questions of issue position, like support for gender equality, support for women's rights. But it then veers into the question of, are there other issue positions that go along with that? Can you be a feminist and be on the left and the right? And these radical right parties are trying very hard to walk this line. Now, I must tell you that feminism, if, you know, we talk about rallies with these populist parties, and I think if they said the word feminism in a rally, there would be boos all around. So there is certainly this strong connotation and connection between feminism and being on the left. But it's more about allowing for self-actualization, for identity, for choice, for, as I said, gender equality. And these are really hard things for a radical right party to kind of rectify.
All right, Professor Walbrecht, you've had some time to compose your thoughts on it.
So I see, and it was perfect because Professor McGee's answer actually was extremely helpful to me. I think it's important when we think of feminism as a political phenomenon to understand that these things are shaped and created. And so my first book was on how the American political parties rearranged themselves on exactly these sorts of women's rights issues. So Republicans were the big proponents of the Equal Rights Amendment and Equal Pay Act and these sorts of things in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 70s, both parties were on the same side. It's not actually surprising that that's when the ERA passed, for example, and then they switched sides. And you could ask lots of questions about why the Democrats, the supposed supporters of the little guy, aren't pro-life, for example, or why Republicans, who are the keep government out of things, everybody controls themselves people, aren't on the pro-choice side. And that's just one example. And so I think in politics, we want to put things together, and that's true of sort of women's rights as well. And I could make strong normative arguments for why certain things like, you know, commitment to civil rights and commitment to feminism belong together, but that doesn't mean that they always have or that they always were. The last thing I'll say is whenever anybody asks me if I'm a feminist, my answer is always that is a label that means lots of things to lots of different people. I can only tell you what it means to me. And what it means is that women should have the capability and should have the opportunity to pursue the roles and opportunities that men have always had, and that the characteristics and activities traditionally associated with women, particularly care, ought to be more widespread, more valued, and seen as more important.
I am grateful for the conversation this hour, and I want to let listeners know A Century of Votes for Women is the conversation that our guests will continue. And they'll have a lot to say. Professor Walbrecht is the author of A Century of Votes for Women, and the 4 p.m. lecture is available through the University of Rochester's Cutler Lecture Series. You can find it online if you want to find it on your own, or we'll post a link on our podcast page when we post it later this hour, or early next hour, I should say. And I want to thank them again, Christina Walbrecht. Professor, thank you for taking the time, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Professor Bonnie McGee from the University of Rochester. I know we'll have a lot to talk about in the future on this. Thank you so much for the time this hour.
Thank you, Evan.
Wonderful conversation with them. Always appreciate the engineer of connections, Rob Braden, despite his Arsenal fanship. Megan Mack, producer, Evan Dawson, saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.